Blog Talk Radio. Greetings, this is Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Tuesday, March the 19th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast. Later on in our program, we'll be bringing you our regular Pan-African Newswire report. We'll have dispatches on the Yemeni armed forces conducting drills in anticipation of a ground invasion by the United States and Britain. Resistance forces are continuing their attacks on the Israeli Defense Forces inside the Gaza Strip. The South African government, in its legal action against the Israeli occupation forces at the International Court of Justice, is demanding action against the genocide in Gaza. And the Republic of South Sudan has closed schools due to the extreme heat in the country. In the second and third hours, we continue our focus on International Women's History Month, looking back on the lifetimes and contributions of human rights and civil rights activist and organizer Ella Baker. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. Stay tuned. We'll take our musical interlude in the Republic of South Africa with the music of Brenda Fassie. Let's listen in.
Oh, mata ni futa kaise yaka sala baka tsone ba ru khamelo
Thank you.
Welcome back, and that was the music and the voice of Brenda Fassie from the Republic of South Africa, a collection of music from the legendary Brenda Fassie. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, a special worldwide radio broadcast, and I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Tuesday, March the 19th, 2020. 24. And we're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. I would like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal. Right now, we'd like to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. And these are some of the headlines in today's Pan-African Newswire. The military maneuvers reportedly lasted in Yemen more than 2 hours with the participation of 1,000 fighters from the region. The Yemeni armed forces affiliated with the Ansarullah group have carried out military training exercises that simulated confronting a potential United States and British invasion of the country. According to the Yemen news agency Sabah, units of special forces of the Central Military District carried out one of its largest combat training and military maneuvers entitled the Promised Day Maneuver on the outskirts of the capital Sana'a. It simulated violent and widespread confrontation operations against enemy forces after it carried out parachute landings on some Yemeni areas and infiltrated some areas. The maneuver simulated violent and widespread confrontation operations against enemy forces after it carried out parachute landings on some Yemeni areas and infiltrated some areas, the news agency said on Friday. The military maneuvers, which took place according to a scenario of complex fire clashes on different terrain, lasted more than 2 hours with the participation of 1,000 fighters from the region, as well as engineering, anti-tank, sniper, artillery, and all kinds of vehicles. And you can read this article in its entirety over the Pan-African Newswire. And we'll give you information on how you can log on to the Pan-African Newswire at the end of this segment of the program. In the Gaza Strip, the Al-Quds Brigade, the military wing of Islamic Jihad movement, released a video showing its fighters targeting the locations of Israeli occupation soldiers in central Gaza Strip. The fighters were using a Malyuka guided missile and mortar shells, which according to the footage, resulted in casualties among the Israeli soldiers. The first scene showed the process of monitoring the movement of Israeli forces in an agricultural area in an unspecified location in central Gaza. It was followed by another scene where fighters were preparing the Malyuka guided missile before launching it towards occupation soldiers. More footage showed a number of Al-Quds Brigade's fighters firing mortar shells towards Israeli soldiers and vehicles. According to the video, moments later, Israeli helicopters began transporting the dead and wounded, despite repeated Israeli assurances that they have pacified or are in control of certain areas inside the besieged Gaza Strip. Daily videos by the resistance indicate that the battles are still raging in all areas inside the strip, including the north and the center. You're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. On the African continent, the Pentagon is working with Niger officials seeking a way for the United States troops to stay in the country, a key base for counterterrorism operations in the so-called sub-Saharan Africa region, following a weekend directive that they had to leave. Last week, a high-level delegation of U.S. officials, including Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Molly Fee, Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, Celeste Wilanda, and the head of U.S. Africa Command, General Michael Langley, traveled to Niger to meet with members of the military junta. Pentagon Deputy Press Secretary Sabrina Singh said on Monday the U.S. officials had lengthy and direct discussions with the junta officials that were also in part spurred by concerns over Niger's potential relationship with Russia and Iran. And finally, in regard to the Republic of South Africa's ANC government's lawsuit at the International Court of Justice against the State of Israel, Israel has urged the top court at the United Nations, the ICJ, to reject the latest request by South Africa for interim orders to prevent starvation in Gaza as part of a case accusing Israel of breaching the Genocide Convention with this military offensive against Hamas. In a written response published yesterday, on Monday, by the International Court of Justice, Israel said that claims by South Africa in its request filed earlier this month are, quote, wholly unfounded in fact and law, morally repugnant, and represents an abuse both of the Genocide Convention and of the court itself, end quote. Israel's response was published on the day that the United Nations Food Agency said that, quote, famine is imminent, unquote, in northern Gaza, where 70% of the remaining population is experiencing catastrophic hunger, and that a further escalation of the war could push around half of the Gaza total population to the brink of starvation. The Food Agency statement came less than 2 weeks after South Africa urged the World Court, quote, to do what it is within its power to save Palestinians in Gaza from genocidal starvation, unquote. That will conclude our Pan-African Newswire segment. You can read all of these articles and reports at the Pan-African Newswire. We want to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussion on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published tens of thousands of articles and dispatches in hundreds of newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. If you'd like to have access to the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast for Tuesday, March 19th, 2024, all you need to do is go to the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week.
You leave your home for days and days, and I know, I said I know, you got another woman somewhere around. Hey, I'm a good woman. Don't treat me like dirt. I don't go nowhere. You don't take me out. If I put on a nice dress, baby, you wanna start a fight. Even my next door neighbor notice the shape I'm now. I know what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna move away from here and pretend that I have happiness. Yes, I know what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna leave you. Gonna leave you.
Wonderful Barbara Lynn from the state of Texas, and that track was entitled I'm a Good Woman. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast. This is International Women's History Month, and we've been focusing on some aspects of the history of African and women of African descent. And of course, today we're going to continue with our focus on Ella Baker, the legendary organizer who worked with the NAACP in the 1930s, 1940s as a national organizer. She was the first executive director of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in its infancy. And she was quite instrumental in the formation of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, in 1960 and continued to work with the organization. She was involved with the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party effort to unseat the racist all-white Democratic Party delegation to the 1964 National Democratic Convention in Atlantic City, New Jersey. Let's listen to the continuation of this oral interview from nearly 50 years ago, from 1974, with Ella Baker.
And the motivation behind it being founded to really get at it. And if we were to look at, say, the Bolshevik revolution in Russia, and this is what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to contrast the movement here with other movements. And you know that that movement was rooted very deeply in ideological kinds of considerations. I'm searching for ideology in this movement, but it's so elusive until I'm going to have to conclude, I believe, that there was no basic ideology involved in the founding of SCLC. Not really the NAACP, unless you don't call the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States an ideology, you know, because they don't really put out pamphlets, write conceptual frameworks, which is styles and ideology dealing with the system per se. They come up with tactics and programs to deal with problems dealing with race relations,
yeah.
You know. And I'm trying to really examine it. It's not thought out clear in my mind, as you can see, but these are the kinds of things that I'm trying to look at here.
No, they were. I don't think there was an ideology that certainly was comparable to the Marxist-Leninist concept of a changed society. The nearest to an ideology would be, let's call it the Christian philosophy, and that's tied in with the philosophy of Gandhian nonviolence, mass action, nonviolent mass action. That was the nearest to it. But you see, this in itself becomes an elusive sort of a thing when the, let's call it the impact of the need to grow enters in. And maybe the influence upon individuals, the individual leadership, as to what shall we do next. And the what shall we do next frequently comes from suggestions from sources other than the organization, like the identification with or speaking out against identification with the anti-war movement. This did not develop out of the organization, out of discussion within the organization. It no doubt came as a suggestion to the president and the invitation to the president to come and speak at the anti-war rally. And I know something about somebody saying there's a time now for Martin to speak on anti-war. Do you think that this is the time for it? And somebody would say, yes, it is. And somebody would talk to him, somebody that he felt duty-bound, let's call it, to listen to.
Okay. So the character then, and I'm trying to just theorize here and just give almost every kind of responses,
yeah.
And I want your reaction to them. The character here then, as I said, would be bordering more on an action-oriented kind of a movement than one which would lend itself to a somewhat long-term plan or an ideology based on bringing about permanent social change or change in the system as such. And this action-oriented movement lent itself more to spontaneity than it did to the development of a structure which would require a kind of rigid format down through the years. So this, I think, more than anything else, would reflect the ultimate character that was inherent in what SDIC was doing. Or would you differ with that?
No, I wouldn't differ with that. I think you're quite correct there, because the personnel who provided the leadership for SDLC had never come to grips with a philosophical concept other than the general concept of nonviolent mass action. Now, I don't think there was much, I'll be gracious and say, either time or other bases for in-depth thinking about how far nonviolent mass action can go and to what extent can you really involve people. You see, you may talk about them, but when you respond to, as the organization did, to situations, each situation and their major efforts were in response to situations. And when you exhaust yourself, let's call it, on situations like in Florida, or situations in Albany.
Like St. Aug.
St. Aug and Albany, yes. What do you have? You see, because you haven't, all of this is being done within the context, within the time period of 2 or 3 years. You see, let's call it the overthrow of the Tsar.
No.
It was not a 2-year thing.
Right.
And people, and the general format, not only the format, but the pattern of communication and training and action, the development of an anti-Tsarist movement was much more stimulated, I suppose, by the existence of rather harsh physical conditions. And here you have black people living in quote-unquote conditions that they were in great affluence. I mean, here's the president becoming an international figure. And these harsh conditions were not...
Never really touched
the
body.
Really, never really. Yes. Yeah.
Now, let me...
Pleasure of talking a lot of money.
We were trying to... spell out the character of SCRC, and we concluded that it was an action-oriented kind of a group based on a great deal of spontaneity, and it sought those activities which would allow it the kind of flexibility that was necessary for it to be the star of the moment. And this is my addition to it, the star of the moment. And as a result, it aborted its role as being a long-term kind of a planning organization dead set on fundamental change. And I'll repeat again, these conclusions of Gene Walken, I'm working up to the next point that we're going to raise, Ms. Baker, namely, the role that you played in the settling of conflict within SNCC. So we want to come to that, if we may, because I found that very interesting. But at the same time, I didn't get as much information out of it as I would like to have. And I've read a lot of different accounts, but I want to get it firsthand now. And this is information relative to the compromise between the proponents of nonviolence and the voters' registration at the SNCC meeting in the Hollander School. Now, you suggested, and this has been documented, that you urged a compromise on the basis of the need for unity. What I would like to question you on specifically is how, in fact, did you get these two factions to compromise? You know, who were some of these specific individuals involved? What approach did you use in talking to them? There's no question about your being responsible for the compromise. What I'm trying to question you on is how specifically did you bring it about?
How
Okay. So that's what I'd like to know. I would like to know, and I guess I'd have to ask her more.
Are you recorded?
Yes. The recorder's on. The recorder's on, yes. Now, let me play back. Ms. Baker, we'd like to move away from SCLC per se right now and look at the role that you played in bringing about a compromise between certain factions of SNCC, namely the nonviolence group and the voters registration group. Now, I would like to ask you some specific questions about how you were able to bring this compromise about. The first question I'd like to ask you is, can you recall some of the specific individuals you talked to in either one of the factions and the nature of your conversation with them? I'm trying to get specific information as to how this compromise came about.
Well, I think to cite who was for nonviolence and who were for voter registration, the proponents of these two points, might have some bearing. One, the people who had come out of Nashville were more strongly oriented in the philosophy of nonviolence than any other because of Lawson.
Reverend Lawson.
See, he had gone to India as a young missionary, I believe. Maybe during the days of, you don't have to make yourself so uncomfortable, during the days of Gandhi. And he believed in it. And so you had Diane Nash, Marion Barry, now running for mayor, I believe, of Washington. I think he's one of the candidates for the mayor, I believe. John Lewis, and maybe a couple of other people from Nashville. On the other hand, you had persons who had had some conferences with Robert Kennedy, which would include Charlie Jones of Charlotte, and Chuck McHugh.
Is Charlie Jones a white or black?
No, he was black. He was black. He's,
have you heard of Charlie Jones and
Chapel Hill? I know him. A minister, huh?
Right.
Yes, I know him. No.
Okay.
No relation, at least not on the surface.
Okay.
And Charlie and Chuck McHugh, and I believe Timothy Jenkins was at that meeting. I'm not too sure. They were the people who had had this conference, and I think they were sort of influenced to some extent. So what were the issues? The issue was whether to maintain, you had to have it just as a non-violent movement. Voter registration group wanted a voter registration program. So the basic difference was whether you could have a mass nonviolent movement in voter registration, whether or not you would have the confrontation that the nonviolent advocates were accustomed to and were looking for. So I certainly felt that, number one, historically we had had much too much of dividing forces on the basis of maybe concepts that did not necessarily serve purposes in the long run. And I also perhaps felt and maybe realized beyond the realization of the young that you could not possibly conduct a voter registration program in certain areas without confrontation. That, I think, was the persuasive argument that if you, for instance, see, at that stage, the black belt counties of Georgia were in control of the state of Georgia as far as that proportion of what was that... I was thinking of Southwest Georgia, you see, and other areas around Albany They were in terms of the Georgia Assembly, they were much stronger than their population would warrant. But so what I was pointing out that the county units, that's what I was trying to think of. The county unit system gave them much more strength than their population warranted. And so that kind of information was information that young people may not have had. That's number one. And number two, the persuasive argument, I think, was that once you mounted a voter registration campaign involving mass registration, you would have the resistance that you were looking for. And you could utilize, if you felt it necessary, the nonviolent approach. But the most far-reaching concept was that too much of division had taken place in struggle. And this was not necessary at this stage. And I felt that the young people were in better position to show that they could function and deal with these differing points of view without having to split up to deal, because it had been one of the decisions had already been reached, or at least it had been proposed, I did propose that you'd have two camps. And I was happy to have seen the two chief proponents of these two camps finally work out their difference, Charles Jones and Diane Nash. Now, I think one of the reasons why I was listened to is because I had served their interests from the beginning. After the initial meeting in Raleigh, there were no people around who had the broad term know-how to even bring together the report, or the combination of know-how and facilities to bring together the report to write up certain things. And they had seen me do this. Shortly after that, you see, there was a delegation that had gone to the Democratic and the Republican convention. And how did the material get written? The young white woman, Jane Stembridge, who became the first executive secretary, she and I spent all of 4th of July. She was a typist.
Well,
you see, I had certain input that nobody else had. I had gone through the NAACP period. In fact, I'd lived a long time. and I had related here to things. And so they had seen that I was not ripping them off. And up to that point, they had been able to rely on me to do what they could not do or weren't in position to do at the moment in terms of the nitty-gritty work that had to be done. And so they were willing to listen.
How did they actually antagonize, I'm talking about SNCC now, SCLC and the NAACP? I'm mindful of a memo that went from Roy Wilkins' office to Y.T. Walker while he was executive secretary of SCLC. And he was complaining about a press release that had been issued by SNCC. And Wilkins reminded Walker that SNCC nor any other organization could speak for the NAACP in these kinds of things, you know. And Walker sent him a letter and said he agreed with him wholeheartedly. You know, they said you can't control these young people, boy. They're just doing things all haphazardly, like, you know. So this was one instance as to where SNCC irritated NAACP and SCLC. And this may have been one minute or one very small factor here. So I'm asking you, can you recall any instances whereby SNCC was actually irritating or threatening is a strong word, SCLC or the NAACP?
I think the basic reason for the reaction of, let's say, NAACP and SCLC to SNCC, is the fact that they elected to be independent. And they exercise the independence as only young people or unattached or people who are not caught in a framework of thought can exercise. And they were open. They were open to ideas that would not have been certainly cherished or in some instances tolerated by either the NAACP or SCLC. As a chief example, the moving into Mississippi, when they decided, they called it Move on Mississippi, and they called it MOM. Now, I think a delegation went to talk to Thurgood Marshall, who was then the chief counsel of the NAACP, regarding this, and to seek legal help. And Thurgood was not responsive, in the first place, because the young people expressed the opinion and the determination that they were going to accept help from wherever they could get it, which meant that people like Crockett of Detroit and other members of what is called the many white lawyers, the National Lawyers Guild, which is more leftist oriented, would be objectionable to the NAACP because they didn't want to introduce this conflict of ideologies, you know, the communist, pro-communist ideology, or leave themselves open to a charge on the part of the authorities that the communists were taking over. And so the young people had taken the position. I'm not sure of the sequence of whether this memo, I don't know when this memo, it had to be though after Wyatt came in. The young people had taken the position that they accepted help wherever they could get it. And one aspect of the help, for instance, that was being sought in Mississippi was the utilization of, let's call it, untried or unpopular methods of dealing legally with the questions that arose out of the conflict, out of the struggle in Mississippi. And persons like those who were not within the old framework, the old lawyer framework, were much more open to trying these new things. And we can later deal with some of the specifics. I mean, I can refresh myself sometime or somewhere and find some documentation for you. But this, I think, was the basis. And now, but behind that, I think, to be very honest, was the feeling that here was this group of upstarts that nobody could control. And that they ought to be part of either my organization or your organization. I think we have dealt somewhat in our conversation, I believe, with the fact that at the initial meeting there was this effort, very strong effort, on the part of representation from at least a couple of organizations to have the young people as part of them. And, of course, it was almost a foregone conclusion on the part of SCLC that because the meeting had been called by...
It was delivered.
Yes. Well, I guess they had. I had thought of it that way, but there was a foregone conclusion that since SCLC, quote, end quote, sponsored the meeting, that it was they would be a part. I remember in Raleigh at the time, Wyatt expressed the opinion he was particularly interested in this because he was coming in, you see, as executive director, and he wanted a strong arm. The unfortunate part was that there was an assumption on the part of the ministers, part of the SCLC personnel who was there, that they could literally dictate, I use the term advisedly, dictate to representatives from their area and control their voting. It was at that point I walked out of the meeting. There was this quote-unquote meeting of the chief executives. These are adults and not a young person present, and at which they were voicing such opinions as, I can speak to so-and-so, and I can talk to Thornton from Virginia, and I can control one from Ben Montgomery, Bernard Lee.
Yeah, we're talking about how to use these.
Yes, and you see, this was a completely intolerable to me.
But they eventually experienced a rude awakening in trying to deal with these young people. The young people just went missing to them.
Well, you see, that was their first experience of recognizing that the young people were going to make their own decisions. Because at that time, they found that they weren't able to control the voting.
There was, at this meeting in Raleigh, Dr. King and Reverend Lawson, I think, were the two people that gave keynote addresses. You know, they both were really outstanding. But from reading about accounts of that meeting, one gets the impression that the students were much more impressed with the speech by Reverend Lawson than they were with the speech by Dr. King.
They had to be.
Was Lawson that more knowledgeable and persuasive in his presentation than Dr. King? How do you account for this, the fact that he made a much more profound impression on the youth than Dr. King?
Well, I think Dr. King, in a measure, even from there and in some other instances in my way of thinking, was a victim of his own background, namely that of being a preacher and who had relied to a large extent on the impact of eloquence. And Lawson had not only the eloquence enough to be heard, but he had the persuasiveness of argument. And he also had the credentials, as far as the young were concerned, of having been a part of that student effort in Nashville. And the Nashville group at that initial meeting in Raleigh was regarded as the group because they came with a great deal of indoctrination. They had indoctrination, but they also had provided action, and they had suffered. And so they had their credentials there, and these credentials were recognized by the young. And as far as Dr. King was concerned, his speech, I don't remember his speech, but his speech could not possibly have had the same relevance, because even if he, that Lawson did, because he had not been engaged in what the students had been doing with the same degree of membership, let's call it. He was still outside.
All right. This is a little derivative, but it's not too far in line with what we're talking about. And this brings to mind a man by the name of Vincent Harding.
Yes. Oh, I love Vincent.
Now, the reason I'm bringing up his name right now is that I've been informed somewhere in my interview that Dr. King somewhat feared or was a little bit reluctant to deal with in a very open and comprehensive way. Personalities such as Vincent Harding and Reverend James Lawson. Did you get an impression like that? Did you ever get the impression that King regarded these men as somewhat of a threat to his position with their knowledge and power of persuasiveness?
I could say I got the impression that specifically that he was loath to do this. But I think I can make a generalization that Martin suffered from self-protectiveness that frequently goes with one who has been accorded high place in public image. And he was not sufficiently secure, I think, to feel that he could exist and they could exist without being without feeling that they were competitive or threats. I don't think he may not have been conscious of that. I don't know. I won't say. But this is not uncommon, you see. Especially is it not uncommon out of the background which he comes. You have to continue to emphasize that he had not had the kind of organizational discipline that either that Lawson had had. Or Vincent, because I think Vincent was part of
Friends.
Yes, and he had, you see, that's dialogue. That's where people talk things out a lot. where they have been had a long series of discussions on. See, Marvin had not had these things.
And his PhD in ethics and philosophy couldn't possibly prepare him for this kind of...
No, because you needed to have some... I don't care how much reading you do. If you haven't had the interchange of dialogue and confrontation with others, you can be frightened by someone who comes and is in position to confront you.
That's right. Especially if they confront you with an air of security and
independence. Yes, and they come with their own credentials.
Yeah.
You see. And there was an insecurity, I think. I don't know whether he was ever aware of it, but it's a natural insecurity coming out of that Baptist tradition. Because, you see, the Baptist ministers have never had been strong on dialogue.
Who's
it's
this?
Victim.
Now we're talking back again to SCLC. Can you recall any ministers in that organization that impressed you as being individuals who sought practical ways of dealing with problems and the institutionalization of a policy-making kind of apparatus in SCLC? Was anybody who was put pressure? We mentioned Shuttlesworth and people like Jamison out of Louisiana, you know. But can you think of any other people who was trying to apply constant pressure to the creation of a kind of a structure which would allow for the dealing and a tactical and flexible situation for dealing with practical problems and institutionalization of a decision-making apparatus?
Well, I would think Kelly Miller Smith certainly would be a person within that context, you see, was in the national situation too. But I think he was not too happy, with the lack of that developing. He wasn't too happy with the manner in which the structure was being developed or the mechanism for decision making was being developed. But you mentioned the Shuttlesworth. I think they questioned inside, but you see there's also this business of closing ranks after the questioning.
Explain that for me.
That means we are on the same board. And if we are inside, behind closed doors, we can differ. But when you have, quote, end quote, the great leader, you close ranks in public. And that in itself sometimes decimates the effectiveness of the dialogue. Especially when the leader is open to advice and receptive to advice and from others.
Okay. That's very good. That's very informative and enlightening there, because you had explained earlier this closing rank kind of thing. And in addition to decimating, it has an almost emasculating kind of an effect, especially on a strong personality. When behind closed doors you can pour it all out, but you never can enjoy the whole pour for trying to influence people to your way of thinking, you know. And this is something I'm going to have to examine and try to see just how strong-willed people dealt with this kind of a situation. I think a man like Kelly Miller Smith of Nashville, a person like Fred Shuttlesworth, had to be uncomfortable and frustrated a lot of times because these were people who wanted to express their own ideas and ways of doing things, I think.
Well, in all probability, but I think Kelly was perhaps feeling more secure at being in Nashville and having played a role there, and he may have even reached a point of wanting to retire from a certain kind of role. I don't know. See, what am I predicating that upon? The fact that I don't think he has, since the students of Nashville were in the confrontation issue, in the stage of confrontation, I don't think he has been instrumental in developing any program that facilitated confrontation. So that's number one. And a person like Fred, he had his own machinery that was continuing in Birmingham. Up until the time of the Birmingham quote-unquote movement that Martin identified with, he knew he was able to keep going. See. So I think this is part of it.
All right. So, well, let me ask you again about this man, Reverend Y.T. Walker. He assumed the executive directorship right after you, after your acting directors, yeah,
whatever you call
term,
it,
or whatever. Right? I'll see. I'm trying to give a name. I don't know. So, can you enlighten me on the process involved in selecting Wyatt C. Walker, number one, who recommended him? You know, and after his recommendation, who interviewed him? That, like, I know you and Mr. Levinson talked to Reverend Philly and subsequently recommended him, and he was eventually hired. Can you explain the process of selecting Wyatt C. Walker?
Well, Wyatt had a movement involved in Petersburg. I think at the stage that he came into contact with Martin, he came as president of Petersburg, whatever it was. He had also been identified with CORE in Virginia and had worked with NAACP in Virginia. His daughter, was the guinea pig in the school situation in Petersburg, you know, after the 54 decision.
That's what happened to my son in Thomas.
Is that so?
Yeah, using him as a guinea pig. I'd never do that. I'd never advise him about sending that kid to one of them all-white shoes.
Yeah.
I couldn't do that in good conscience.
No, anymore.
Never.
Yeah.
Never be a pioneer again.
Well, Wyatt had that experience, plus he had been to several of the meetings. He was not at the organizing meeting, I'm not sure. But he was at the conference, the first of the so-called nonviolent conferences that was held at Spelman. Forgot about those.
I
did that one too. That's where I met him. I didn't know him. I knew of him. And I think he had been coming to meetings. Now, who first spoke to him about being executive? I am not sure whether I'm the one, but I think I am. He and his wife were visiting New York, and a good friend, a mutual good friend, George Lawrence, the Reverend George Lawrence, I had known George in his escalation up the ladder. And I invited them to come to the house. I even cooked the lamb. We had dinner, and I raised the question of Wyatt of being the executive director. Now, he may have had inclinations and aspirations for it before, and he may have been approached by somebody, I don't know. But I do know that. And I am not too sure whether I probably may have spoken to voices around in the circle of Martin a lot. I don't know, because I hadn't left completely then, I don't think. And so that was a first step that I know of. And so, of course, Wyatt being the personable individual he is, and a contemporary, age-wise and style-wise, let's call it, of Martin, that was not too difficult a bridge to cross, and they had had very little or no success in finding a minister to be the executive director.
They were still a
minister. Yes, it had to be a minister. Certainly it had to be a male. It had to be a minister still.
I told you about those criteria selection.
Yes.
It was a point that he was trying to make. It's another thing I don't know. But he certainly suggested that we ought to consider a person who may not necessarily be a minister. The implication being that executive skills should take priority over his religious affiliation, you know, or his religious meaning. And Reddick and all these other people made similar kinds of suggestions. But it's nowhere stipulated that he can't. Yeah, one man, Reverend Lowry, suggested that it should be a minister. I made his objection to the president, so everybody's there.
Where?
In terms of documentation.
I'd be interested in the dates on that.
Well, it was before the selection of Reverend Philly.
Uh-huh.
It was a criteria suggested for them to consider in trying to get a person like Reverend Philly.
Well, I think maybe Martin's verbalizations regarding it did not necessarily have to be a minister. Could have come as a result of his consultation with persons like Stanley and was fired, and then even maybe to my own presence there at the time, see. And the fact that they had made approaches to other ministers and had not been a minister of a certain standing, like my kids, you see, and had not gotten a favorable response.
So it was,
and it may have been more political than to have made that kind of statement.
Right, and he's not a minister,
yes.
You know, to that effect.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is they did select a minister.
Yes.
I can't get around.
And they only have had the minister, Stephen and the young.
Can you think of any layman that played Turner Rose or were elected to any official position in? Well, I don't have any record of it. Maybe you can recall something that hasn't been written down. Can you think of any layman that was elected to a position other than a lawyer? He had I.F. Augustine.
I feel. Augustine.
Augustine.
Yeah.
And he's the only one that I've seen who's not a minister listed in some permanent position.
Well, no. The only non-minister who was, as I recall, with the executive board was Dr. Simpkin.
Yeah, that's right. He's an MD, not a...
Yes. No, he's a dentist, DBS. Yeah, he's a DBS. And I think, but you see, he had a good movement.
That's right. That's right. They should be calling him. They should be.
Yeah, there you are.
This brings me to questions about other people whose name I've seen frequently in the earlier stages of SCLC. For example, Dr. Reddick, who was formerly at Alabama State. Designated official historian of the organization. He figured prominently in a number of executive committee meetings, his name.
Yes.
You never see what they said because I don't have records of the minutes and I haven't been able to find them. But can you recall what you perceived his role to be in the organization, Dr. Lawrence Reddick?
Well, Reddick was in Montgomery at the time of the, I believe, at the time of the boycott. Certainly he was there at the time of the drive to his freedom, and I think to a large extent may have been the actual writer, if not the actual writer, certainly the guiding hand in the development of that
book. Of course.
Yes. So there was a certain amount of rapport, let's call it, that had already been established and between him and Martin, and then Martin, of course, being male. And a PhD, he would have some respect for one who was also who had these credentials. So he was part of the executive committee, but I'm not sure that he had any overriding influence at all. And then he left Montgomery.
Yes, and went to Coffin State,
and then from there to Philadelphia. Yes.
That's where he's presently.
Yes.
I was in touch with him while
he was there. I see. I don't know. You haven't had a chance to...
No, he told me that he would talk with me, and he would try and see what he could contribute to my study, you know, but he was the official, and still is, historian. You know, and a historian to me is a person that's supposed to have all...
You haven't had a chance to...
No, he told me that he would talk with me, and he would try and see what he could contribute to my study, you know, but he was the official, and still is, historian. You know, and a historian to me is a person that's supposed to have all the records.
He hasn't written any history.
Not
sizable.
No, he's written this thing about the Friendly Warrior, whatever it was, on the biography of Dr. King, the Montgomery movement. But beyond that, he hasn't turned out too much about SCLC.
No.
And I'm, you know,
Now, see, he had input. He had capacity for input in the area you first mentioned regarding when you raised the question of Bolshevik Revolution.
Yeah.
He had the knowledge about these things. He had also some association with the.
He should have figured prominently in the development of an ideology
if he was known in history as president, you know,
yes.
And their deliberations and...
Well, perhaps he could not speak, because, first place, when you have you're faced with a complete embankment of ministers who feel that, having been called by God, as they claim, for leadership, why, that's enough. And who had not had the discipline of thinking and the real dialogue, especially dialogue that differs. Yeah.
Well, let me go to this here. This is, you had one assignment that I think kept you frustrated a great deal. This is the person, I guess, I'm looking at the documents and your reports on them. You were in charge of book Strive Toward Freedom, and the assignment I'm serving for numbers of books to different people throughout the country. Was that as a frustrating experience as I perceived in looking at your responses and your tallies of the number of books you'd given to various ministers, the amount of money that they had turned in, and some of them trying to make the case that they didn't get X number of books and things of that sort? Was this a really frustrating experience, or did you take it in stride?
I hope that I took it in stride, more or less, but it wasn't part of what I had conceived of as my role. But after all, you see, I was just there to do what, quote-unquote, had to be done. I mean, this is the concept, you know, this would be the first thing that would come up, you see. When the book came out, Tilly went to the National Baptist Convention, and I went to Detroit to that other Baptist convention. And from then on, and especially, I think Tilly was gone, and I would have to get these books shipped out and all that kind of stuff. No, and of course I had to devise my own scheme without any time maybe to deal with it.
Right, you had to have somebody in Detroit to help you.
Yes. Because no preparation had been made, you see. I'd forgotten about that.
Of the books, the amount of money you collected.
Yes.
You got rid of all of them in Detroit except three books. All
yes.
The books were accounted for except three.
Except three, yeah. I remember doing that.
Yes, that's right. All of that is there.
Yeah.
But this was supposed to be a source of revenue for SCLC. Did it really bring in...
I don't think it has ever been a big source of that. I don't think the amount of money that, certainly that part that came in while I was there, would not be considered, in my opinion, a big source.
Right, a lot of time and energy and personnel was invested in bringing this thing off. You know,
yeah.
It's part of Dr. King and the organization itself. And I don't know if it balances out in terms of gain received with the amount invested in it or not. And I was curious to answer that.
Well, I wouldn't, certainly directly it did not, as far as I could conceive of it. Especially going to these conventions, I didn't think of it. I don't recall what the total came to be.
Well, it's listed there.
Yeah.
You have it down there. But another conceptual kind of a question. Did they ever attempt to define in any specific way the role of the executive director and associate director?
Well, when you say specific, you...
just give you a job description, you know, like you attempted to do.
You didn't get it beforehand, and I think after we had been pushing for certain things, and I said... Because I remember in my last days, I was pushing for not only job descriptions, but certainly certain other bases of consideration.
Certainly, coffee break.
Yes.
You know, your whole memo about this.
Yes.
And
this was predicated upon the fact that there were people. People came without the same kind of experience and training that the person, let's say, was there with me and was getting more. But this is personal. This I, of course, objected to. Thank goodness the child group, the young lady who came, I think I told you she came from that part of your...
South Atlanta.
Yeah,
And she was one of Y.T. Walker's secretaries.
No, but she may have stayed there a while after he came.
She did. And she resigned to go to Lockheed.
Lockheed,
she wrote him a letter of resignation.
Yeah, because, you see, there was nobody else there. And they, I think the Reverend King brought in one of his former church secretaries as a bookkeeper, I believe. And then that was this great division of capacity, responsibility. That was not the necessary rapport that should have existed. See, I'm sure Mrs. Brown, I believe.
That was the name,
yes.
Mrs. Brown.
She had so much capacity, and thank goodness we were helpful in getting her to release herself from the syndrome.
she did.
Yeah.
Now, we've been talking on the periphery. I'm going to ask you directly now, treat it in the way you see fit. Can you describe your relationship with Dr. King for me? What kind of a relationship did you have while you were working as a person in charge of the Citizenship Project, as one who served as associate director, and as one who served as acting?
Well, in the initial stages, I practically no relationship. He was not relating to the situation too well, let's put it that way. They were living and still in Montgomery, and he would come to Atlanta, and I'd never seen him.
He was the president of the order.
Yes, he was.
Well, who did you relate to in terms of trying to...
Who was helpful?
Right, and who suggested to you what your role should be in the organization?
No one. There was no one, after all.
okay.
No one had suggested to me, because first place, the background for conceptualizing it was not there in terms of the leadership, the top leadership. They had this idea of having these meetings. See, that's where it stopped. Pardon me.
Mm-hmm.
And so then what does it take to get those meetings? I think they, to a large extent, Martin was depending on buyers, you see. Of course, at the last stages, I think for the last couple of days before the meetings took place, buyers came down. But you see, he didn't need to come down then. But of course, that could also be taken as proof of his, after all, if you're supposed to be the top strategist.
You and Byers designated as co-directors of the Citizenship Committee.
Yeah.
On the letterhead of all of
this. Yes, you see. So, that's the way it goes. From the standpoint of my relationship with Mark, I think it was mutual, almost mutual tolerance in a certain sense. I understood from the beginning that I didn't go there with any hope or any expectation of being a key figure recognized as such. But this is another one of those efforts that I felt that, all right, things had to be done. I was in position to do them, and hopefully it would be part and parcel of a contribution to moving things ahead. I think that maybe from Martin's standpoint, you have to tolerate what you have to tolerate. I don't know. I had heard in later years that he said or felt that, I don't know whether he said it or someone else, that I don't want to say I hated him or disliked him or something like that. But you see, Martin wasn't good at receiving critical questioning, and he was not alone, because this is a pattern of ministers. And to come, see, after all, who was I? I was female, I was old, I didn't have any PhDs, and an interesting angle. There was news conference there. There was a little gathering between NAACP officials and the CLC officials in connection with some voter registration program. Roy Wilkins and I think Bob Carter came down, and then of course there was Martin and Ralph and others, and then of course there was the news conference, I remember, I believe it was Ralph who said to me he wouldn't have let himself be ignored in that situation. You see, I rolled in it because I knew more about the history of voter registration and what had taken place in the struggle equally as my, I at least was familiar with all the things that the NAACP had done, see, historically. Martin didn't have that historical information, tip finger, he had not been active in getting around in that current period. So, but it didn't bother me. Maybe it should have. I don't know.
Well, here's the thing that kind of bothers me, that I lost in understanding. There was a question about press releases. I guess they suggested to each other that no press releases would go out of the office unless they first read and approved it, you know. And they must have told you that or something like that, because I got the impression that a memo or something you sent back to Martin that the next press release you would let him read it before it would be released. Did you ever have any difficulty at all with them on press releases?
I don't recall too much of a difficulty because maybe I didn't recognize it.
Well, this was a little nuanced kind of a thing.
Well, you see, I was on my way up there.
Oh, and you was informing him that...
I had indicated that... I think it was in December of 59 that I would, December or maybe early 60, that I would be leaving. I think I left in August of 60. I stayed there till Wyatt was chosen.
Well, I was trying to detect from that little memo
whether
or not you had been trying to put a spin on it, whether or not they were trying to put a stranglehold.
Well, I'm sure, you see, they were, I don't know what, I don't remember any press release that they had any basis for objecting to. But, see, I had to write letters and sign Martin's name to them. And a couple of occasions, for instance, a situation in, I think, the mayor of Birmingham or something there, and he brought the issue up to him, sent him information on it, and nothing came, so he eventually did it. Sent a letter out, or certainly now when the meeting was held in Columbia, South Carolina, the letters that are signed nominally by him, who wrote them? you had to get them out. So I don't recall that. There probably was a growing feeling, you see, that.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. I can't recall it.
If you happen to dig up that memo, I'd be
in your copy.
Yes, I'd be glad. I'll clarify as best I can.
There was a situation involving when did you let them know that you wouldn't be back? Did they give you any indication that they would be happy for you to leave, or they didn't want you to stay around, and you just decided that it was best for you to just get on out of the thing?
There was every indication, you see, from the beginning that my presence there was not one that could be a very tolerable situation for me, in the sense of what role can you play effectively. You feel the breach of having nobody to instigate or to conduct to draft or get together that initial meeting. I went to stay 6 weeks. That's all I had planned. And then after that, they were still without anybody, so I stayed on. And then when the sit-ins broke, I suggested, of course, that there needed to be some at least, a meeting of sit-in leaders for the purpose of communication, if not coordination. That's how I had the April 1960 meeting in Shaw, out of which SNCC as a viable organization got its roots.
I was curious to ask you about that because it kind of stood and see that kind of demo.
Well, in all probabilities, there were lots of consultations and discussions around my role and around me that did not come to my life. I'm confident.
Did you and Martin, did you recall any confrontation that the two of you had that was a little volatile? You had an argument of anything of that sort? Why you were just, as you suggested earlier, tolerating each other?
I would raise questions about things that were intolerable, not to me as such, but policy-wise. I like the question of the differential in salary for a young person who was capable and had come under difficult circumstances and worked effectively, getting less than someone who was brought in and did not and wasn't doing too much, see, at number one. The differential there. I would confront on the basis of regulations regarding how you hire people and how what kind of rights they had and sort of things like that. And I would also raise questions about any issue that came up that I did because I would voice my opinion on. So I think the situation was a mutually tolerable situation. Now I recall it just comes to mind, the newsletter James Timbridge and I started. It's a beautiful, you know, having a copy of that.
I have one copy of the newsletter.
Yeah.
One copy of where you indicated all the meetings. That's the only thing that all of the meetings that they had. But there was no content about what transpired at these meetings, but I do have a date, and I can go back and try to get newspaper accounts of things in these cities. Did they ever report on these meetings that took place? Like you had a nonviolence conference in Durham, you had one in Shreveport, you had one in Montgomery. At the same time, during the years of 57 and 58, there were about six meetings.
The largely mass meetings.
A mass meeting. These were large mass meetings.
Yes.
Did they ever report on these meetings in the newspapers?
Well, they would hope to have the press there. See, this is part of the format. Big meeting.
Would the local newspapers report on?
Well, I don't know.
You never did check into these meetings?
No. They probably had some reports. I didn't. We had no record. I didn't keep any record.
So that's way I'm going to try to get at that.
Yeah.
I'm going to first get the local newspapers cities that you met in. I have all of them listed here.
You see, wherever Martin went at that time, at least some news coverage took place.
Yeah. Well, I have all the meetings listed, the dates of the places they took place, and I'm going to try to get these newspapers to give some reading of the temple.
Now, you see, for instance, the initial meeting that was held in Montgomery, at which the name of SCLC was determined. I was there.
Well, I thought that meeting took place in New Orleans. That was the second meeting in February of 57. Yeah.
Well, what do you have there for a meeting in Montgomery?
Well, I mean,
fighting each other. Because he had respect for me, and he had respect for me going way back.
Right.
Even as a student, I was in position to sort of elicit respect for that position. And I had respect for him. I don't recall our having too many actual conferences about what was to be done, because, see, this was coming from he had a great deal of sensitivity to carrying out let's call it the wishes of the president. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
Yeah.
Burger.
Yeah. And therefore, his initiating that may have been a frustration even for him. See, although he was not a very aggressive person in the sense of wanting to dominate the scene, or at least showing the desire to dominate the scene. But it had to have some degree of frustration. Because the president was so often you couldn't find him.
Yeah. This was a thing that you give the impression of. I gave the impression that he was the most businessman in the country. In order to get Dr. King to speak at a particular place, you have to contact him about a year and a half in advance. Unless it involved the person that potentially, had potentials for
getting. Welcome back. And that was a recording earlier on done with Ella Baker in 1974 about her experiences with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and the early phase of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee organizing efforts. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast for this Tuesday, March 19th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit, and we'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal. And you can have access to this program by going to our website at the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com / Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/ Pan-African Journal. We'll take a break. We'll be back with our concluding segment of our program.
I made a solemn vow that I was gonna be a lady. a mansion in an elegant New York townhouse flat, and I ain't done bad.
With the track entitled Fancy. And we're going to conclude our program for today with an address delivered by Ella Baker in 1968 in New York City at the Southern Conference Education Fund conference held during that time period. Let's listen in.
And author of The New Abolitionist, Howard Zinn.
This isn't going to be a long introduction because I think the most useful thing I can do is not to stand between you and Ella Baker for very long. I do want to say it was somewhere on the streets of Atlanta, I think it was somewhere in 1958-59, that I first met Ella Baker, and it was one of just a passing meeting. And somehow I just was with her for 5-10 minutes, and yet I felt after that meeting, thinking about it, that I'd been in the presence of a remarkable person with enormous strength and passion and hidden wells of wisdom. And then I saw her in 1961 in Albany, Georgia, at the time of the mass demonstrations there, and all sorts of things were going on out in the street, and people were being arrested, and Bob Zellner was hanging around somewhere, coming out of jail, and other people, some of them right here in this room. And in the little church in Albany, back in the dark, in the back room, there was a line of people who had just come out of jail, black men and women, Albany. And they were sitting there, and there seated at a table was Ella Baker. And while all this hoopla and demonstrative action was going on out in the street, Ella Baker was sitting at this table talking one by one to these people who'd gotten out of jail to find out what they needed. Did they need some clothes? Had they lost their jobs? Who was taking care of their kids? They need a doctor. And it seems to me that over the years that I've known her, what has really impressed me was that on the one hand, she was always doing the nitty-gritty, down-in-the-earth work that other people were not doing, while all sorts of rhetoric was going on, and all sorts of grandstanding was going on. That's what she was doing, working with people and talking to people and organizing people. And yet at the same time, she always had a vision, an intellectual reach, an understanding of what lay beyond today and beyond tomorrow, what lay beyond the immediate events. She always was looking through the things that were occupying people at the moment, thinking of the kind of world, I think, that she and the rest of us thought we were working for a world without war, without racism, without poverty, in which people could live together as human beings were meant to live together. And then I felt very honored when she and I were both serving together on the executive committee in SNCC, and those first few crazy years of SNCC. And she's had a long and remarkable career in the South, where she was born, in the North, where she has traveled and worked among all sorts of people. I listened before, as some of the messages said, that she is one of the most consequential and yet one of the least honored people in America. And I thought to myself that perhaps this is because we are accepting the going definition of what honor is. If honor is medals and headlines and plaques and invitations to the White House, well, that's somebody's definition of honor. And if honor is the love that people have for you, and if honor is the work that people do and the cause that you've dedicated your life to, then Ella Baker is one of the most honored people in America. It's only rarely in one's lifetime that you come across somebody that you consider a truly great person. And that's the feeling I've always had about Ella Baker. It's been a great privilege to know her. It's a great privilege to introduce her to you now. Here she is.
Mr. Chairman and friends, I don't know if I can recall a point in my lifetime that I have been as near speechless as I am tonight. I had said that I'd had great difficulty trying to put down something to say, not only because of tonight's occasion, but because I suppose, like many people who have lived a long while, who've seen a lot of things take place, and who still want to see where we are going, I am among those who are finding it pretty difficult to talk these days in the first place. And tonight I am finding it even more difficult, because I must admit I had not responded to this occasion in the way that apparently other people have responded. Maybe I am at fault. But when Anne asked me if the dinner this year might be, quote, built around me, I said yes without any hesitation, because I agreed with one other statement she made, namely, that of course this has elements of using you, but if you're like me, you do not object to being used for a good cause. And as far as I was concerned, this was it. Because irrespective of whatever else could take place tonight, to me the most important reason for being here was for some people who did not know about SCEF to learn about its work, and for others of us who have been involved in its work to gain new life and new dedication to its support. Now, maybe I was wrong in taking this position. Maybe I should have let my ego find some satisfaction in the fact that quote, I was being honored. But I must admit to you that I have always found it very difficult to play that role, because in my estimation, one must do what one's conscience bids them do, and from no one except yourself expect applause. I have been introduced in various ways in my life. I've had the introductions, maybe I should be a little bit historical or reminisce a bit. I remember when I traveled for the NAACP in the early 40s and throughout the South. I was weighing then about 40 pounds less than I'm weighing now, and I was 27 years younger. And on many occasions when I arrived in a place, because the people had been accustomed to seeing what we used to refer to facetiously as bedecked and bebosomed ladies, and here I appeared with neither bedecking nor not too much bebosoming. It was pretty difficult for some of the persons who had to introduce me to find a sense of security in presenting the speaker. And so what they usually would say after some words that maybe could be said about anybody, they said, and here we have our national officer. And this, of course, meant that they said, well, don't blame me if it isn't all right. It's the national office that sent us. But in 59, I went down to help them in an effort to break through the barriers to voter registration in Caddo Parish, Louisiana. And among the things that we were doing, of course, was getting around to various sections of the community to try to get people to understand how they would have to, what they would have to do in order to qualify to register, and to get them to come out to attempt to register. And on one occasion, after we had been around a while and my work habits had become known, one of the dear brethren who introduced me, after he asked the sister to say, he said, now if this sister will give us a number on the piano, and then we will have a few words from the old workhorse. And this was what I was supposed to represent. Now, I remember those instances, and I remember hundreds of other instances when I had the privilege of thinking, at least, that I had spoke what people were thinking in their hearts. I remember one occasion in the height of, I guess, the war that was being fought in the 40s, I spoke at a church in Tampa, Florida, and there were about 200 people present, and we were recruiting NAACP memberships, and out of that group we got about 80 that morning, and one sister got up and said afterwards, she said, I'm joining because I know what this woman is saying, what she is saying, any mother can understand. Now, I wasn't a mother, but at least I was glad to know that in attempting to communicate, I had communicated with people in terms of their understanding and in terms of their drive. A lot of nice things have been said about me tonight. But I said that my main concern for being here was because this was an occasion to call attention again to the work that SCEF is doing. You've heard it said that this is the 30th anniversary of its existence. And I know of no organization that can measure its effectiveness more effectively in terms of the repressions that it and its staff has suffered than SCEF. SCEF As Ann has indicated, or at least my meeting with Ann and Carl came at the time when they had been accused of a number of things, sedition among them, because they had bought a house and sold it to a Negro veteran who had been unable to buy a home out of the ghetto. And the house was then, I think, bombed, I believe. And the veteran and Carl were accused of having done it themselves. And I met them. I then was strictly a civil rights worker. You know, in the civil rights movement, there was not very much difference made or distinction made between civil rights and civil liberties. In fact, we may not have dwelt too well upon civil liberties in those days. And after meeting Ann and Carl, one of the things that became very clear was that those of us who were engaged, especially the young people at that time, who were engaged in the nonviolent movement, had not understood that the very laws that were being used against them, like freedom, like opposition to assembly, like exorbitant and unusual bail, these were things that had to do with the civil libertarian aspects of a struggle that they knew very little of. But thanks to Ann Braden especially, those who had not known came out of the movement, I think, at least informed, and I trust are now convinced that the struggle has to take on a double effort in the direction of combating the violations of the civil liberties that we claim to have as a result of being a part of the American system. I've often felt that the marches were just, to a large extent, outlets for people finding expression, and they assuage their sense of guilt, or they did away with any further need for involvement by becoming a part of the march. They are necessarily, no doubt, they are a necessary part of dramatizing a situation. But why march to Washington? Why not march to Long Island? Why not march to Westchester? Why not march to the slums of New Jersey? Why not march to Harlem, to Bedford-Stuyvesant? Not in terms of a physical march, but in terms of recognizing that what is happening in these places in terms of poverty is a responsibility that has to be dealt with by those who are not impoverished. In other words, those of us who have money have got to speak to those who are in power in a way that they understand, which is how? Through the ballot, through your pressure, and through the determination that something has to be done. Poverty, war, we are pretty well on the way to at least dealing with the question of war, but beyond the question of the Vietnam War is the larger question of what kind of foreign policy does the Vietnam War represent, and what kind of foreign policy will there be after the Vietnam War? Does it represent, as has been indicated in some of the things that we've read, that our government has reached the point that it thinks in terms of being the policeman for the rest of the world against what they call the threat of communism? Or is it truthfully said, as some of us think, that it is the representation of those who are in power taking a position against the inherent right of people to seek their own self-determination in the ways that they think are best suited to their problems? Does this represent the kind of foreign policy that you and I, as citizens of this country, want to see followed? If so, that's one thing. But if not, what is our responsibility? Where does our responsibility begin, and where does it end? When we come to the question of racism, this is the ticklish one. It has been said, and we must give credit where credit is due, the first to perhaps utter this were those who are now not very well received, the SNCC people, when they first said that we are in a racist culture, a racist society that is dominated by a racist philosophy and an exploitation that to a large extent is based on racism. It wasn't heard. And now that it has been said, and perhaps to some extent documented by the report, the president's report on urban disorders, yes. We call them rebellions, somebody calls them riots, and the president's report refers to them as urban disorders. This report comes out and says that we are tending towards becoming two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal. Now, the report hasn't said a thing that hasn't been said before, over and over and over again. But the great tragedy is that it wasn't heard. It was said each time there was a protest against racial segregation. It was said each time that people like Stokely Carmichael got his head beaten because he was trying to resist the racist aspects of the Southern society. And then we were much more eager for the fight against racism because of what? It was over there. It was in the South. We could always point the finger. But when it begins to explode at our very doorstep, what do? We get afraid. And we get fearful. Now, it's understandable. It's understandable that you can be afraid of disorder. But that is not enough to be afraid. There is a need to understand the reason for the disorder. Not an outbreak has taken place, but what there weren't some factors that had obtained for years and years that had helped to create the climate, create the hatred, create the suppressed anger that made it necessary in the minds of the people who gave vent to it the way they did, to do what they did. This, you say, is condoning the rioters. It is not. It is an effort to say to people who say they would like to do something to save a country, it is an effort to say to you and to me that we must understand what takes place on the riot, at the riot level, is a reflection of a lot of things that have not been on the surface before and that have been festering like an old sore. And what happens with an old sore when it festers? Frequently, it infects the entire body. And we are now at that stage, I'm afraid. One of the things about the question of racism that, or at least in talking to people, The question that frequently has come up recently with me is, well, we are not guilty, personally. Of course, you're not. I don't know that there's anybody in this room has carried on a campaign of racism per se. But I doubt that there's anybody in this room who has not at some point been guilty of supporting a racist culture. And we must search ourselves to find out how we have been guilty. Not for the sake of just wallowing in our guilt, but for the sake of facing the fact that the future of our culture, of our country, depends not so much on what black people do as it does depend on what white people do. Now, this is a hard lesson for some of us, that the choice as to whether or not we will rid the country of racism is a choice that white America has to make. But you say that when blacks call for separatism, they are guilty of racism in reverse. How many times have you listened when the separatism is echoed? What's behind the call for separatism? There are many things are said, but in my estimation, there are times when the most radical makes the statement that you can't expect anything from Whitey. What he is really saying is, show me. He is begging to be shown. Now, how can you do it? I don't know. I wish I knew how you could show. But one thing is certain. You can't wait, sit back and wait and say, well, if the blacks aren't going to work with me, I don't want to be bothered with them, and I don't want to interfere with their receding. And if someone asks me, well, what can I do? I have only one answer. You have to do some things in terms of what you believe and in terms of your own conviction. And if you're not going to be able to be motivated by your own conviction and not wait for blacks to tell you where to move, then we are doomed.
Welcome back. And that was Miss Ella Baker from an address delivered in 1968 at the Southern Conference Educational Fund in New York City dinner, where she was honored. She was introduced by Professor Howard Zinn, the historian. And that's going to conclude the Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast for today, Tuesday, March 19th, 2024. We've been broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. If you'd like to have access to this program so you can share with other potential listeners and listen to it again and again and again, just go to the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. If you'd like to read the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And you can always share the podcast of the Pan-African Journal. All of the programs are available at the Pan-African Radio Network. And we're going to close out with the music of Abby Lincoln, one of the legendary pioneers in black music in the United States. This is taken from an album released in 1961 entitled Straight Ahead. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week.
Got a problem getting where you want to go. Speed limit's almost down to nothing. Straight ahead, but oh, Miss Lucy, put that music book away. What's the use to keep on trying if you practice till you're gray? You can't start no notes of flying like the ones that rant and ring from the kitchen to the big woods when Melinda sings. Easy enough for folks to holler, looking at the lines and dots, when there ain't no one can sense it, and the tune comes in spots. But for real melodic music that just strikes your heart and cling, just stand and listen with me when Melinda sings. Oh, it's sweeter than the music of an educated band, and it's dearer than the battle songs of triumph in the land. It seems holier than evening when those silent church bells ring, as I sit and calmly listen when Melinda sings. Sweet chariot when Melinda sings.